So is that it? You're just going to sit there? Come on, Piggy. At least say something.
I hate you.
See, that's good. Now we have a dialogue going.
I can't believe you went to see other puppets. Is it that French marionette?
Well, every puppet wants to try a marionette.
You disgust me. I hope she gives you warts on your little...
Fine. I don't think we want to go there. Look, I agreed that in all statements to the press, we'd say it was your idea, that you're the one who wants to start seeing other puppets.
We did? I do? I mean, I do, but not puppets. They disgust me. I wouldn't mind giving John Hamm a tumble if he had a different last name.
That's great. That's the whole idea of the separation. We each get to experiment. As Fleetwood Mac said, you can go your own way. It's my favorite band.
Yes, it would be.
So, you want to introduce the show?
I suppose so. This is a show about puppets who bring delight to people of all ages until you find out they're double-dealing, two-timing amphibians with pathetic midlife
crises.
Getting
off track here.
So settle in and enjoy it. And now, the last living member of the Fireball XL5 fan club, Colin McEnroe.
I did love Fireball XL5. It's actually true that at my university, a well-known university located in New Haven, we would occasionally reenact Fireball XL5 action scenes as marionettes. Anyway, we didn't know that Miss Piggy and Kermit were going to actually have a sort of possibly publicity stunt separation in the news on the week that we were doing a puppet show. This show about puppets has been planned for a long time. But there you go. It's sort of as accurate as today's headlines. And by the way, thank you to Lydia Brown for being Miss Piggy in that intro. All right. So we're going to talk about puppets today. The reason, the main occasion for this is, in fact, this incredible puppet festival, the National Puppetry Festival of 2015, which will run out there at stores, at the epicenter of American puppetry, one could argue, August 10th through the 16th. We've got with us here in studio Bart Rockaburton Jr. He's the director of the Puppet Arts Program at the University of Connecticut, and John Bell, director of the Ballard Institute and Museum of Puppetry and an associate professor of puppetry. So we're going to talk a lot, particularly in our second and third segments on the show today, about what's going to happen in that festival, what's coming in from the international world of puppetry. There's a lot of things that sort of qualify as puppetry that aren't maybe your exact traditional idea of a puppet. But we're also going to talk a little bit about the psychology right now of puppets and puppetry. Joining us is Robert Askins, a playwright whose Hand of God has become, I like saying this, a smash Broadway hit. I like saying smash. A smash Broadway hit was nominated for 5 Tonys this year, and it's a very tough ticket to get, as I have found a couple of times already. So Robert Askins, first of all, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, man.
And welcome to Bart and John, who are here in studio with us. I want to sort of maybe begin by with a quote from Basil Twist, who's also a big deal in puppetry these days. He said, "The crucial point about puppets is that they are real and unreal at the same time." Bart, that's sort of something that if there's one true statement about puppets, that might be it, right? One thing that applies, that somehow or other they're on that balance. They're playing with our own ideas about what's real and what's not.
That's absolutely true. It relies on our imagination to help bring them to life. And I would add to that statement that they are both alive and dead at the same time.
Why is that significant, or why do you mean that?
We are taking an object that has no life and moving it in such a way to give apparent life that requires the audience to join us in that creation, in creating that illusion.
And John, is that part of the reason that puppets occasionally do freak people out?
Yeah, I think so. They because you don't know whether they're alive or dead, and we play on that all the time. And then at the same time, you do know that they aren't dead, but then you're participating in this game to say that they are alive. So it's constantly bringing up this question of identity and existence, even though we're making jokes about Miss Piggy and Kermit, or about religion or whatever. But behind it all are always some pretty interesting and complex ideas. So it's entertaining and enthralling.
So Robert Askins, I've read that occasionally, maybe even on opening night of Hand to God, there were people who kind of got up and fled, who got a little scared. I mean, this isn't necessarily a very scary show. I mean, it's a dark comedy. First of all, is that true? Are people occasionally freaked out by Tyrone, the puppet?
Absolutely. We've also had people have panic attacks. We have had to call ambulances, which is very satisfying for me as a dramatist.
Yeah.
And it's, I think what the gentlemen are hitting on is exactly right. Like, we enter into the ritual space in the theater, and it is both real and not real. It is both true and false. And I think that actually highlights how much else in the civilization is arbitrary. So when you watch an incredibly skilled practitioner put on a sock and give that sock life, and then your body, while you are watching the show, mistakes this experience for reality and responds to stage blood as if it were real blood. Do you know, at one point in the show, I don't think I'm giving anything away, a kid's ear gets bitten off, and it spit at him. And, of course, we're in the theater. This is false. Like, this is patently false. But people respond as if it were real. And I think more than just participating, the audience is. The body is fooled even while the conscious mind is not. My body is programmed or conditioned so that when I see the red squirting out from a particular body part, I am scared. Something has happened. It has been disturbed. While my conscious mind knows that this is theater, my body thinks that there is danger. And the friction between those two, the shuttling back and forth between danger and safe, I think is what gives us the dramatic thrill.
Yeah, Bart, I think I've talked to you about this before, but I remember seeing a marionette show by Daniel Butterworth where and it's very sort of Brazilian and carnival, but dark and freaky too. And at one point, he lays one of the marionettes down on the stage and goes over to get some other stuff, to do some other stuff, but there's nothing happening quite yet, so your eyes are still on the marionette. And then you realize it's breathing. Its chest is going up and down. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm having exactly the reaction that Robert's talking about.
Yes. Again, you watching that object are adding your imagination to it. The puppeteer is moving the object in a certain way to cause you to say it is breathing. Of course it is not breathing.
No, it's breathing, man. It's totally breathing. So Robert Askins, one of the things that you're playing with a lot, and this is even to go to what you were saying before, that's connected, I think, to this idea that, as you said, we're in doubt in our lives a lot just because of the world we live in about what's real and what's not real. Even if we're not at the theater, we don't know that. But there's a way in which part of the conceit of the puppet is that everything else is also potentially a lie. So the puppet is telling the truth, right? There's a way in which you play with that idea with Tyrone, that maybe everybody else is lying and Tyrone might be the only one telling this very horrible and evil truth. I don't know. You want to react to that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in the civilization in which we currently live, we find things that are fairly arbitrary controlling our lives as if they were real. Do you know what I mean? When, you know, subprime mortgages can destroy people's lives, and that's a game we're playing with numbers. Do you know what I mean? The tyranny of the arbitrary is something that we really suffer under. And to have, like, theatrical devices and techniques that acknowledge that and play with that is a relief, right? And even if to try to take those things back to the first materials and see, like, at base, what is real? And using the false to try to point at that, I think, is it's at least a fun game for a comic playwright to play.
And John, you were saying before we went on the air, that's a game that puppeteers sometimes don't really entirely stop playing. You said that there have been puppeteers who've been arrested and brought the puppets into court and kind of said, no, it was the puppet?
Yeah, that's happened more than once where the puppeteer succeeds in convincing the judge or the jury that I didn't say it, the puppet said it. And in that case, the legal system engages in the artifice, the idea that the puppet is real. Or uncanny, what was discussed a few minutes ago, is the term that Freud uses, this not knowing whether something is alive or dead and playing with that. And that uncanniness is always with puppetry as well.
So, Robert, your play, first of all, you're not a puppeteer, you're not a puppet guy, the way all these people coming to the National Puppetry Festival are going to be puppet people. But you grew up around puppets, right? The Christian puppet thing was part of your childhood?
Yes, my mother had a Christian puppet ministry.
Yeah.
And even before that, I was held back from kindergarten to first grade, and they used a puppet, a therapy puppet, to explain that situation to us. The puppet was a dolphin. His name was Duso. and we have to sing to it every time we would meet with the school counselor. And I think that is the beginning of my fraught relationship with puppets. But I also did. I studied puppetry a little bit in Prague with a man named Petr Matasek when I was in college. So I was drawn to writing, but the puppets are a common through line in my life.
I'm guessing, did you actually still remember the song that you would sing to the dolphin? You have such a clear memory.
Hey, do so, come on out. That's the part I remember. And you would repeat that over and over until the dolphin came out.
You know, Bart, you were saying that you and John were saying before the show, this world of Christian puppetry is an outlier world, but also not an outlier world. You've got students coming in who are part of that,
yes,
right?
Yes. Within our student body, we have people who come from the Christian puppetry area. We do not, in our training at UConn, we try to get the students to figure out how to express their own ideas. So within class projects, if one of the Christian puppeteers wants to express Christian ideas, they're allowed to do so. At the same time, if someone wants to express something that might be rather risque and adult, they're allowed to do so. I don't censor it, but we do warn our audience at all times.
Yeah. So, Robert, what kind of Christian puppetry was your mother doing? What do you remember from that?
Well, I think when these churches and these people in these churches have a little bit more money, it's like, well, what are we going to do with it? Like, obviously, we're going to do something for the kids. We're going to try to keep the kids occupied while we tell them a story they've heard every Sunday for their entire lives. And the answer to that is like, oh, well, there's these packages online. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's something new, and it's something fun, and it's something to put the money to. And then it ends up being like these, you know, two camels mm-hmm. on the night that the star first appears over Bethlehem, and the camels are talking. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the scripts they're not great. I mean, some of them are good. But in a way, it's also a sort of fun reappropriation. You know what I mean? Because they're puppets and because they're slight, it allows for people to take the divine stories and dirty them up a little bit and cute them up a little and funny them up a little bit. And I think that's one of the most powerful things that any art form, especially an art form that is not viewed as a high or holy art form, like you can reappropriate. You can take the master narrative of the civilization and make it your own. You can fold, spindle, and mutilate it until it looks more like your life. And I think that's really beautiful.
And, well, John, also, one thing the puppets are good at doing is taking something abstract and making it real, or taking something that's difficult to understand, even sometimes taking a piece of literature that's difficult to relate to. I think it was one of your students, Dubar, somebody who'd made a puppet movie out of some obscure Nathaniel Hawthorne piece that I'm sure I wouldn't get all the way through reading. But a puppet can kind of take something. I mean, a lot of religious concepts are abstractions, right?
Yeah, because it becomes real. It's this object, like a crucifix, thinking of the history of religious puppetry, or a Javanese puppet. Javanese, Asian and African puppets are really connected with religion, interestingly, along the lines that Robert was talking about. But it's this object that's right there, an idol or a statue, and everybody attaches meaning to it in their own different ways. But you know it's in the case of Christian puppetry or Christian ritual, you know that's a kind of holy object. So it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And as you're saying, it's concrete. It's made out of wood or cloth or something. It's really right there. It's not an abstraction at all.
So we're talking in studio to John Bell and Bart Rockaburton. They are the two dons of the Eastern Connecticut puppet mafia, a very powerful Cosa Nostra indeed. And we're talking to Robert Askins, who's got a huge hit on Broadway with Hand to God. So, Robert, one of the things that you really did was take this puppet idea. And, you know, I mean, John and Bart, they live in communities of puppet makers and puppet masters and puppeteers. You took this puppet idea and you dropped it into a world of actors and a director who just, they're not puppet people. One of the first things that had to happen was the guy who's the lead in your show, who is going to be both playing the human being and the puppet. He made his first version of the puppet, right? There wasn't a Tyrone sitting around for him to learn on. My understanding is he made the first Tyrone.
Yeah, that's true. Steve, we were going to do the very first reading. We were all sort of involved in a theater company called EST with a young playwright unit called Young Blood, and Steve had been doing work for me and with me for a long time. And the first version we were doing was just at music stands, and the director had mentioned that maybe we would use an oven mitt for the puppet. And Steve was like, no, I've got to, you know, most of my job in this reading is interacting with this puppet. I need something at least a little bit believable. So he just searched online for easiest puppet to make. And he found the sock puppet, which is sort of a Muppet style with these two arms that you could make. And what was really genius about that, and I think this is what's amazing to me about Kermit as opposed to the rest of the Muppets, is that with the sock, you can see him articulating his knuckles underneath the fabric, which gives a wider range of facial features to the puppet. And Kermit, if I'm not incorrect, Kermit and maybe his cousin or nephew or whatever are the only ones that are built like that. Everybody else is the soft styrofoam head. And so they get less articulation. They have less facial features. It's Kermit's world, and everybody else just lives in it. Anyway, but Steve made that puppet, and it just sort of went off from there. And it was, I think Steve definitely acknowledged the traditions of puppetry and, like, studied with different people. But I also think he really got to build his own vocabulary in making this. Like, we never made an attempt to hide the movement of his mouth. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the gesture of that combined two-voice character, Jason and Tyrone, is that Tyrone is saying the things that Jason can't. So it's interesting to watch his lips move even as Tyrone is speaking. There's something, again, like the dead, not dead. It is separate but not separate. And I think that's one of the difficult things to understand about the personality. There are many voices in my head. They fight for my attention. I am not one thing. It's one of the terrible lies of narrative is that character is one thing, or at most two things, and we do not have story constructions that allow us to explore duality very well.
You know, Robert, I mean, I have worked a couple of times with Bart's puppets, and it doesn't take very long for you, for me, or I think for people who are around puppets, to start having that line blur a bit, you know, about and no matter what you tell yourself, no matter how clear you are, this is a puppet, this is a person, the two are not the same thing. Boy, it just doesn't take very long before it gets kind of muddy. And I'm wondering, just as going through an incredibly rigorous rehearsal schedule and followed by a performance schedule, did that start to get a little muddy and freaky for the actors, for everybody else involved in the production?
Absolutely. At one point, you know, Steve, his fiance at the time, but now his wife, were all pretty good friends, and she was saying at one point she woke up and Steve's hand was in the air looking down at him like Tyrone in the middle of the night. And she's a good storyteller, but I don't think that's crap. And Steve also, you know, during the rehearsal process, sometimes it would come to a halt because Tyrone was doing material. Do you know what I mean? Like, Steve, of course, was doing Tyrone doing material, but Tyrone, the character, was also just stopping rehearsal making jokes. And the thing of it is, we let him. Mm-hmm. Like, what? We were having a good time.
But you cut him more slack than you would have cut Steven.
Exactly. You know, Moritz, our director, was just, he was rolling on the floor laughing, as whereas I think, if another actor would have pulled that, he would have tried to get us back on track very quickly.
I'm wondering how, but you know, for Bart and John, I mean, you deal with people who have puppets in their blood, right? It's just right. Sort of, so, I mean, maybe they're the ones who are the most clear-headed about it, but maybe not. I don't know, I want to hear from both of you, but Bart, what's your take on that?
Well, my students I work with constantly, and from my perspective, they are looking at the puppet as an instrument that mm-hmm. they're expressing themselves with. So I don't see them getting caught in it, but they are also – I mean, there are times, as Robert is saying, where the puppet says something that you didn't know it was going to say.
Yeah.
And it's shocking.
Right.
It's really shocking.
You mean the puppet says saying something that you, the puppeteer, didn't know it was going to say?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, John, you're nodding.
Yeah, because it opens up these parts of your brain that you wouldn't otherwise have access to. I think along the lines that Robert is saying, you do start saying things that you wouldn't say if you weren't operating the puppet. So I think that's totally true. I think with puppetry, you're engaged in this eternal moment of play. Like kids, you know, kids who are 8 and 10, they can play with toys for a long time and totally invest themselves with that. And with puppetry, there's something similar going on because you're aware of who you are and you're aware of who the puppets are. So you don't get confused, but you need to play with it all the time in order to kind of figure out what the puppets want to do. And that idea of what the puppets want to do is also something that puppeteers feel. Like when we're loading puppets in or out, we were loading out last night from our studio. It's like we're always saying, like, well, where does this want to go? Where does the object want to go? Where does the puppet want to go? Because it's not like where do you want to put it? It's this idea of the agency of the object that's mm-hmm. always there, and we're playing with that back and forth all the time.
Play is a really key element in puppetry. One thing that I use in the puppet arts program is a thing in German called der Spieltrieb, which means the play instinct. That thing that we're taught to leave behind as we get into high school. That's what I'm looking for in my kids, is the ability to play.
Robert Askins, you went into this as the playwright. You weren't a puppet virgin, as we said. You were surrounded by Christian puppets growing up. But was the original concept maybe a little bit more glib than this has wound up being? In other words, I'm going to invent this character, and he's going to have a puppet, and the puppet's going to be evil and possessed and say all this demonic stuff. And did this sort of, in all the ways that we're talking about right now, did it get more uncanny than you were really expecting it to?
No.
No.
Absolutely not. I mean, this is the first comedy I've written. Everything I wrote before was sort of dark, bizarre westerns or, you know, sort of semi-Greek white trash tragedy.
Cool.
Tyrone is specifically designed to make darkness palatable. You know what I mean? Because I was noticing in play, in the theater, in America, it's difficult to say the hard, dark truth and not have people turn away.
Mm-hmm.
So Tyrone was written not to be cute and funny. He was written to be the most palatable way to say some of the darkest things. And that's been fairly successful. Also, like, sometimes the theater is a very safe place. We go in and we know what we expect from a play, and we don't expect it to behave badly. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And when it does begin to behave badly, we're a little bit offended because the theater is almost like church. And Tyrone is a way to confuse that and to disrupt that and to have the play behave badly at the same time as it continues to entice.
So I know you have to go. So last question. Having said everything that you and the other two guests have said so far, let's go back to that first question. So when people freak out and bolt out of the theater and run up the aisle or have panic attacks and you have to call the ambulance or whatever, what do you think is happening to them? I mean, it's something involving that supposedly safe churchy space that being fractured. That seems to be part of it. Is that what's going on, or are they like really afraid of Tyrone in a different way?
The first production of the Eumenides, which is the last play in the Oresteia,
mm-hmm.
Historically the lore is that when the Furies come on stage to hound Orestes, there was a woman in the audience who was pregnant and she miscarried.
Wow.
Right? Like, that's the lore.
Yeah.
And that's how dangerous theater can be. Mm-hmm. You know, Ibsen caused riots,
mm-hmm.
you know? And this is something that is, again, false, but it's also so writ into the DNA of our social artistic understanding that it has the power to essentially disturb the way we live, not just our bodies, but the way the civilization functions. The theater is a loaded gun, and not many people want to pick it up.
All right.
I'm
well,
very interested in that.
Yeah. First of all, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations on your hit. If people want to meet Lamb Chop from Hell, they should go see Hand to God. Thanks for being with us, Robert Askins.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
Okay. So we're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of John, more of Bart. You're going to meet Peter Schumann from Bread and Puppet Theater as well. We'll talk about the Puppet Festival coming to us.
Very happy monsters feeling glad.
Very happy monsters feeling glad.
Very happy monsters laughing. Very sobbing monsters feeling sad.
And we're back. We're back with more Puppets and Puppetry. In studio with me, as I said before, we have Bart Rocker Burton Jr. He is director of the Puppet Arts Program at the University of Connecticut, a position he's held since 1990. He's also the festival director of this 2015 National Puppetry Festival. Runs from August 10th to the 16th. John Bell with us, director of the Ballard Institute and Museum of Puppetry and associate professor of puppetry, author of many books on puppetry as well. Joining us now also, Peter Schumann. He is founder and director of the legendary Bread and Puppet Theater, which is based in Glover, Vermont, currently the subject of an exhibition, Speak Up, Speak Out, Bread and Puppet Theater and Activist Art at UConn's William Benton Museum of Art through October 11th. So, Peter Schumann, just to sort of add your voice to the conversation, there's a way in which we were sort of talking before with Robert Askins and with Bart and John about this notion that if everything else is a lie, then the puppets can tell the truth. Now, we were talking about that more sort of psychologically and socially, but another way in which this can work is sort of at the level of activism, of satire, sometimes maybe even counter-establishment, counter-government demonstrations, right? That the puppets can say stuff that nobody else is allowed to say. Is that one of the functions they have for you?
Yeah, I think that's also historically how they started to be what they are. So they were able to say things, sometimes with the use of a swazzle, that normally people couldn't say. And they said it loudly and clearly, and they were often thrown out for that loudness and clarity. And, yeah, the records, a lot of records of puppetry are in our police records. So, yeah, that's how it is.
I want Bart and John to tell us a little bit more about the festival that's coming. Peter and Bread and Puppet will be part of the festival. But so give us a sense, Bart. What's coming to UConn Stores Mansfield?
Well, from August 10th through the 16th, we are going to be presenting over 20 performances coming from French Canada, from Brazil, from across the United States. They are varied performances. Some of them are for adults. Some of them are for families. Variety of types of puppets as well. And actually, I should let John talk about this because he is artistic director of the festival. I'm director dealing with the budgets.
So, yeah, John, give us a sense of some of the – I mean, one of the things that's – maybe it's always been the case. I mean, there's a lot of things that you can call a puppet. But I feel almost as though those boundaries are under pressure all the time, being stretched all the time. What are some of the edgier things coming in?
Well, we have traditional marionette shows, a Wizard of Oz show from the Midwest. We've got tabletop shows. We have a whole toy theater mini festival, which is tabletop flat cutout work. The Bread and Puppet Theater is doing a giant spectacle called Captain Boycott, which I'm sure Peter could talk about the history of the actual Captain Boycott and what the contexts of that might mean for 21st century activism, one could say. We're doing a big outdoor puppet parade on Saturday the 15th, an instant puppet pageant directed by a Bread and Puppet veteran, actually, Sarah Petey. Outdoor shows, indoor shows, some shadow shows. So we're hitting a lot of the different ways that puppets function in the world today. And in the critical exchange sessions, we're talking a little bit about robotics and new technologies, which are totally connected to this world of puppets and performing objects.
And we're also running a film festival simultaneously.
Right. There's a real puppetry film festival that every day is going to present a variety of different puppet on film projects.
And we feel that we have a really broad spectrum or broad roster of talent. Bread and Puppet will open the festival on August 10th in the evening in Jorgensen Performance Center. The next night we're presenting I Am Big Bird, the film that has been released. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing to make it different is that Carol and Debbie Spinney are going to be sitting on stage with a remote control so they can stop and do live commentary on the film simultaneously. And that event's going to be introduced by Cheryl Henson, Jim Henson's daughter. Just yesterday, we cinched in Sonia Manzano to co-host Late Night with Eugene O'Neill. She plays Maria on Sesame Street.
We should mention you have Eugene O'Neill in puppet form here right now, right?
Mm, yeah.
I wish there was, you know, a more visual component to our radio show. So, Peter Schumann, you know, at this puppetry festival, there's going to be a lot of things that are going to be called puppetry. Is that a category that's really interesting to you? Do you either care or not care what gets called a puppet? Is there something that's a definition that you think needs to be adhered to, or is the landscape completely open?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we are modernists. We are going to bring a virtual reality, so people are going to sit there. We're going to put a screen on top of everybody's head, and then we wire everybody's brain to that, and then we press buttons. And then everybody individually can get their own show out of what we do.
All right. So, see, it is endless. Well, I mean, John Bell, I mean, there is a way in which puppetry is in an odd axis. On the one hand, it really is one of the most traditional forms of entertainment. It's got to be one of the oldest forms of entertainment, but also one of the most traditional and the most basic. I mean, in the novel Ridley Walker, you know, technology and civilization have been essentially destroyed. Everything that we have right now is a way of moving information around, including virtual reality screens that you put over our heads and inject puppetry into our brains. That's all gone. There's no and so things get explained by puppets because that's what's left. So there's sort of that. But there's also, in a way, which puppetry is constantly connected to modernism. Whatever modernism is at a moment, there's some reason why puppets get plugged into that.
Well, it's always had this connection to really basic and traditional puppetry. Like Punch and Judy is a popular show. Amy Trumpeter will be performing a version of that at the festival. And that's really a medieval theater piece. It's got the devil in it. We were talking with Robert Askins earlier. The devil performs in Punch and Judy. You don't see the devil performing too much in live theater. So you have these older forms, marionettes and hand puppets that are traditional, that are Western. You have non-Western forms. But then you have these larger questions of the objects. It's always about focusing attention on the object, whether it's a wooden puppet or a cloth sock puppet or a shadow show or something like that. And the objects we have with us today, as Peter was saying, are there's a lot of screens, there's a lot of machines, there's robots, there's digital technology. Those are all cases in which we're looking at the material world, vibrant matter, and not at human beings themselves. And so inherently, there's a connection between traditional forms and modern forms. I think a lot of Peter's work is fascinating because of the materials he chooses, like in the exhibition at the Benton Museum right now, modern materials like Celastic, but also wood that the Bread and Puppet gathers from its northern Vermont home, and paper and paper mache, cheap materials, easily accessible materials. So whatever the materials are, the materials are saying a lot about the nature of the performance.
Right. We have a clip of Peter Schumann talking about his cheap art manifesto. Let's hear that.
The White Cheap Art Manifesto. People have been thinking too long that art is a privilege of the museums and the rich. Art is not business. It does not belong to banks and fancy investors. Art is food. You can't eat it, but it feeds you. Art has to be cheap and available to everybody. Art is cheap. Hooray.
So, Peter Schumann, those are your words, and obviously they fit very well with what John is saying. Although it seems as though with puppetry there's a lot of options ranging from the most basic kinds of materials to, as both of you are essentially saying, space-age materials, robotic materials, and computer materials. Or does that sort of violate the Cheap Art Manifesto?
No, it's, you know, it's in keeping. I think we, this time the biggest thing in the show we are bringing is really a lot of nude bodies, a lot of nudity. Oh my God, piles, a whole population, a nude population. So where can you get a nude population to perform? All you need is a bunch of cornstarch and paper and clay and you can produce them in a few days. So it's the possibilities are pretty endless, and that's you will see see in this festival various interpretations of those possibilities.
You know, Bart, I could be wrong. This sort of could be just me as a Connecticut resident thinking this, but I always feel like, you know, there's what's it called, Charleville-Mézières, you know, which is where the École Supérieure Nationale des Arts de la Marionnette, that's in northern France. It's like the mecca of European puppetry. And then I feel like there's sort of Storrs, right? You guys have so much. I mean, what is it about Storrs in Mansfield, Connecticut? How did all this puppetry energy get collected there?
Well, it started by a man named Frank Ballard, who was my teacher. Frank was a puppeteer from the age of five. He saw a puppet show, The Proctors, when he was five, went home and started making puppets out of the only material in his father's garage he could make the puppets from, concrete. Mm. And he worked puppetry all his life. He came here in the late 50s to be the first technical director of the Jorgensen Performance Center. But his puppets were always there. Mm-hmm. And in 1965, he had the opportunity, based on the Academy in Prague, to establish an MFA program in the training of puppetry, thinking about what had happened in theater, 20 or 30 years earlier, that suddenly theater became a university subject instead of something that you apprenticed into. And Frank built the program. He ran it for 25 years. I came in as he retired in 1990, and now I'm in my 25th year.
Mm. So, John, there's kind of two things running side by side there in Storrs, right?
It's somewhat complicated to explain, but there's two programs: the puppet arts program, as Bart explained, and in which I teach as a professor, and then the Ballard Institute was started with Frank Ballard's collection, but also this idea of preserving the global arts of puppetry, and we've received a real boost in the last year and a half with a new museum space in downtown Storrs, where we can show all sorts of different work, our global collection, which lets you see the worldwide reach of puppetry and its connections to religion and art and politics and entertainment, and then various exhibitions like our current one of Yukon puppeteers over the past 50 years, or before that, an exhibition by Hartford artist Ann Cubberly and her amazing work, and Rufus and Margot Rose, who were Connecticut puppeteers, very active in the early and mid late 20th century, doing amazing work with marionettes. So the Ballard Institute is this sort of public outreach part of it, connected with the teaching of the puppet arts program, and we go back and forth all the time working with students within the two programs. So it's a powerhouse of puppet interest.
Yeah, we're symbiotic programs that support each other, and the educational program is so much richer because of the existence of the Ballard Institute. And I need to say also that the remarkable support that we're getting from the university at large, from the president to the dean to our department heads, just for the programs, not to mention this festival coming in, it's amazing.
You know, I want to leave a little time for our final segment here. I do want to say that I've had the privilege of working twice now with Bart's puppets. Always Peter and the Wolf, though. I'm typecast. I'm pigeon. Now that you heard my Kermit voice, maybe you'll let me try to do some other stuff. But I've also had the chance of working a lot with Ann Cubberly and her kinetic sculptures. And as we know from a previous show that Bart and Ann did together, she doesn't always like the P word. And so here's a little Jim Henson clip about that, too.
It's not like talking about the Muppets' real secrets.
Secrets?
Do we have secrets?
Yes, we do.
Yeah.
All right, everyone. We don't have to listen to this anymore.
No.
I know what you're asking for, JoJo. And I suppose you'd like me to talk about puppets.
Did it? Oh, no, this is terrible.
He said the P word.
Oh, are you crazy? Are you trying to ruin us?
Don't look in here.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more about the P word when we come back from this.
Well, this has been a good show for me to poop on. It was produced by Alex Dubin, much better than those boring shows about books he always wants to do. I could get more entertainment licking part of my leg. Greg Hill handles the WNPR Twitter account. What does he do with the other 138 characters after "This sucks"? Producers Betsy Kaplan and Lydia Brown help with this show because it's cheaper to keep them busy than putting them on the medications they need. The part of Bill Curry was played by Captain Who Cares? He's Ancient History. For show pages, articles, and pictures of the Faith Middleton Show staff sniffing each other, go to the horrible website WNPR.org. Tomorrow's show is about air conditioning. There's still time to make other plans.
And now, back to Colin.
All right. We seem to have gotten Triumph the Insult Comic Puppet Dog to do our thank yous. So that was very disturbing and frightening. So we're going to move on now, talk a little bit more about the Puppetry Festival. And by the way, you can go onto their website. John, what's the website? Because I just reading the list of all the things that are happening, all the performances they're going to be, it took me like a half an hour to go through them all. It's an incredible number of things. Where can people find out what performances they could go to?
It's National Puppetry Festival 2015. That's the URL, but if you Google National Puppet Festival or UConn, you'll find it. National Puppetry Festival 2015 is the URL.
.com,
yeah.
So one of the things you can do at the Puppetry Festival on Monday, one of those performances, Monday, August 10th at 8 p.m., Captain Boycott. This is Bread and Puppets, and it's a performance in, I think, three parts. Tell us, Peter Schumann, about Captain Boycott. Yeah, except that I'm not sure Peter is there right now. All right, John, you're going to have to start by telling us a little bit more about Captain
Well, Boycott. As I was saying earlier, it's a like a lot of Bread and Puppet shows, it's about an interesting historical moment, the moment in Ireland in the 18th century, I believe, when a landowner who named Boycott, who was exploiting the tenant farmers on his land, faced opposition and an uprising from the tenants. And the show will be performed by 30 volunteers from the Connecticut community, which is really an interesting way that Bread and Puppet works. They do giant spectacles very cheaply by incorporating the community. So there'll be 30 people rehearsing with the show. The show, as Peter was saying, involves a lot of very large, over life-size puppets that are basically bas-relief sculptures made out of paper, paper mache that are like 12 or 13 feet tall. There are wonderful stage tricks with giant curtains. There's music. There's brass music. There's big choral movements. There's interesting text that Schumann writes that sometimes is oblique, but wants to get at the nature of what drove people in the 18th century to rise up against this exploiter, Boycott, and what they did as a nonviolent active movement. They invented the term boycott in order to support the things that they wanted to have happen. So it's a traditional story of oppression and reaction to oppression, performed by these incredibly skilled puppeteers, including one member of the company, Joe Therrien, who's a puppet arts graduate, is now part of the puppet Bread and Puppet Company, and all these volunteers. So it's going to be colorful, lively, a lot of music, dance, etc.
You know, by the way, it turns out that Peter Schumann had to rush off to a rehearsal. That is so fitting. So that's where he is. So, you know, Bart, in the Robert Askins play, In Hand to God, you've got a lot of actors, regular actors who are working with puppets or reacting to puppets. And Stephen Boyer, it just turns out, happened to be really great at learning to do puppets and work with this particular puppet and pull off the characters that he has to pull off. But it seems to me there's a real difference. I mean, it's not axiomatic that a good actor is going to be good with puppets or a good puppeteer, or that a good puppeteer is automatically a good actor. What are the similarities? What are the differences?
Yeah, absolutely. What I'm looking for, I'm going to go that way, Colin. What I'm looking for when I bring students into the program is the ability to create. I'm looking for creativity. Mm-hmm. I'm also looking for someone who's willing to work very hard. People think puppetry is a lot of fun, and it is. It's a great deal of fun. It's very satisfying, but it's a lot of work. Mm-hmm. The difference between the two performers, you're looking at it from a puppeteer's perspective. Mm. We say the actor pretends, the puppet is.
Well, you know, that's – I mean, although it's interesting, John, the way in which those kinds of things interface at times. I mean, that's certainly happening in Hand to God, but there was a production of the Public Theater a few years ago – I think I even have the name of it here – in which there was – in which Anne Frank had to appear on stage. And they decided, because Anne Frank wasn't really going to appear on stage, that it was going to be sort of a vision. They thought about different things that they could do. They could try to put some effect, layer it on to an actual actress on stage. They could try to do something with lights and mist and stuff like that. But they ultimately decided on a marionette built by, I think, somebody named Atchison. You probably know who that person is.
Oh, Matt Atchison.
Yeah, Matt Atchison.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Anne was represented by – the play was called Compulsion. Anne was represented by a foot-and-a-half-high marionette designed by the aforementioned Matt Atchison in a little red dress. And she would come and stand on the desk of this writer who was obsessed with Anne Frank. And so, I mean, this is the other thing that I think happens more and more is you have a problem on stage. How do you deal with something that isn't easily addressable by traditional dramaturgy? And then you turn to a puppet or a marionette.
Yeah, I think that can do that because it's hard to present a character like Anne Frank. You can act a character, and that's been done before. But a puppet is really there. I was thinking about the challenge for actors, and I think it's about shifting focus. If the actor is able to shift focus and take this piece of wood and string and cloth with the red dress as Anne Frank that's a foot tall on desk seriously, then it's all going to work out fine. And I think sometimes, and I don't know if it's about actor training, and this is one of the great things about the Puppet Arts Program and its relationship to actor training and theater training at UConn is that people get that sense of how to work with puppets. It's not really that hard. It's just a question of trusting the puppet and being able to work with the puppet on stage and say, well, yeah, that is Anne Frank. I'm talking to this thing. People do this with ventriloquist dummies all the time, and to just give it that legitimacy.
Yeah, actors have to believe in the life of the puppet they're working with. Otherwise, mm-hmm. the puppet is going to upstage them. Several years ago, I worked here with the Hartford Stage for one of their playwright workshops, and Michael Eliano, I hope I'm saying his name right, did a piece called The Children. He had gone to see a production of Medea. And this was shortly after the Susan Smith incident when the woman drove her children into the lake in the station wagon. Michael went to see Medea, and he came out of it saying, why didn't somebody stop her? She said she was going to kill the children. Why didn't she stop her? So he wrote a play based on that and asked me to add puppets in as the children. And at first I thought, this is not puppetry. But after we did it, the audience responded by saying that the puppets protected them from hearing an actual child actor say those words.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never thought of puppetry as protection. But they were right. It worked.
And it seems like that barrier, too, is breaking down a little bit. I mean, you know, the thing of the public I just talked about. I saw the most mind-blowing production of Midsummer Night's Dream. It was by an Irish theater group, I think the Druid Theater maybe. And they had some work with puppets on stage, but it wasn't a puppet show. And when they wanted – they had no actor cast as Puck. When they wanted Puck, they would just make him on stage. They'd have like a flat iron that would kind of – they'd make it kind of appear to float in the air, and they'd put some ears and stuff like that. And then any actor could voice Puck. And it wasn't – so this wasn't all puppets. And it seems as though that – I don't know, John, maybe that line has always been blurred. But it seems like, you know, something that doesn't necessarily have to be a puppet thing or a non-puppet thing. There's a lot of convergence.
Yeah, I think objects, you know, like a found object used to represent Puck, objects have a certain power with them that is routinely accessed historically in all sorts of different cultures. You know, fetish objects they talk about, or we're talking about Freud's idea of the uncanny, or idols, you know, in religious practices, or like the way people relate to their smartphones. You know, that's an object that people are dealing with routinely, and they have the utmost confidence in this object. They're paying attention and giving legitimacy to that object at an amazing level. So those objects are functioning all the time. I was thinking that an interesting flexibility aspect of puppets is that they routinely allow people to perform different gender, different race. There's a lot of discussion about gender and race now, and puppets have always been in the middle of that. So it's
I think at the festival there's even going to be at least one act that involves rap and hip hop too. So absolutely, get yourself out to Eastern Connecticut from the 10th to the 16th. Check the schedule, find something you want to see. Thanks to all of our wonderful guests, especially John and Bart, who are here in studio with us, and thanks to Alex Dubin. He's the guy who really pulled all this together. I can't believe what Triumph said about him. So unfair. So unfair.
Outrageous.